This is the Biz of Wealth. Challenges, rumblings, and evolution of the wealth management industry.
Welcome to a Business of Wealth. Today, I had the honor of sitting down with Habib Moldatiro. He is a member of the founding team and CIO of V-Square Quantitative Management, a subsidiary of Valor Equity Partners. He's an accomplished and dedicated senior executive combining a science academy background with an extensive investment management experience gained throughout a career at major global financial services companies in Europe and the US. He's an adjunct professor at New York University, a 20-year quantitative investment management veteran who garnered major recognition as an expert in portfolio management across the market spectrum and accrued a wealth of knowledge of the capital markets, the regulatory and operational frameworks. He successfully led numerous strategic initiatives, resulting in investment solutions and products for investors across the globe, many of those focused on environmental, social, and good governance matters. He ardently believes in the value of building and maintaining a two-way bridge between academia and the industry. And this was a very interesting conversation we had about how to best manage asset management businesses. Without further ado, here is Habib. Habib, welcome to the Business of Wealth. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you, Alejandra. Very nice of you for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here with you on this sunny day in Miami and in Chicago where I sit.
Well, I've heard great things about you, so I'm excited to get this started. So tell me just a little bit about you. I always say, what got you here and what's here? I just heard, you know, a very recent move for you. So tell me a little bit about it.
Yes, that's a good question. Here is actually Chicago, Illinois, where I moved. I recently moved 2 months ago, but to get here, it's been a long road. I am originally from Benin in West Africa. I lived in three continents, in Africa, in Europe, and in the United States. This is year 15 in the United States. I spent the first 15 years in the US in New York, and now I'm in Chicago. Before that, yes, I spent my early childhood in Africa, in Benin, then went to school, high school, university, and the whole 9 years in France, and started working in France for a British company, HSBC, British or from Hong Kong, depending who you talk to. As global asset manager, I was a first trader there. I'm a quantitative investor by trade. This is how you qualify the type of asset management that I do. So I'm a portfolio manager. I spent 11 years total at HSBC, a couple of years at JP Morgan, a few more years at smaller asset managers. But the common trait and the common thread up until now has always been revolving around portfolio management and everything that's around that. So now, why Chicago? It's because I co-founded a company at the beginning of this year. The name is V-Square Quantitative Management, and it is headquartered here in Chicago. My partner, the founder, is also based here. Most of our backers are here in Chicago. I could have stayed in New York. I love New York. It's not a cliche. But it just made more sense to move here. And I can tell you, I'm not seeing the difference now because, instead of being sequestered in my apartment in New York, I'm sequestered in my home here in Chicago.
Yeah. That's the sad reality. But why finance? How did you land into portfolio management?
Why finance? There's a few stories. The main story is that so my background is really engineer. So I was a statistician, mathematics, physics. That's my whole academic background. And coming at the end of my engineering school, When you're an engineer, actually, mathematics or physics or statistics, there's a lot of fields where you can apply what you learned. You could do in bio, in biology. You can do it in pure engineering work, aerospatial, or it could be also Formula One if you like racing. There's a lot of things, and there's also finance. And the reason why I came to finance is because this was an area that was totally foreign to me, and I like challenges. You know, I was growing up, I remember when I was a teenager, even earlier than that, I would be in the car with my dad. He would have the financial news playing on the radio. Although that would be, it's not English words, but that was French words, but it's kind of the same idea. They would be speaking, you know, a regular language, but after 5 minutes or 10 minutes of listening to what they're saying, I would have no understanding of what they were talking about. So I always wanted to kind of decipher this field. So I had some opportunities to actually study finance. And I said, you know, I'm going to move to finance to kind of apply all those things that I learned in engineering school to the field of finance. Now, how do you apply that? It's more, you know, you use statistics or mathematics to try to predict returns or to help in your decision making. And now
the story touches me because I, you know, part of my work is always, you know, simplifying communications in finance. You know, why do we make concepts so difficult, or even products that are so complicated? Right.
That is true. And it's not, you know, I have a big circle of friends or of family, and there's a lot of people who don't understand any of the concepts, even if it's easy. I'm just talking about even financial literacy. It's not something that's totally natural to them. And so they don't really understand, you know, for them, finance, I mean, the only understanding is like, you know, it stops with, you know, the mortgage, or it stops with the consumer loan, or it stops with just banking with your local bank.
So you decided to launch this company. Why, and what do you do? What are you doing?
So the company VSquare is a global asset manager. Mm-hmm. So global asset management is what I've done so far. It's year 20 now of my career. It's been 20 years. Actually, on December the 4th, it's going to be 20 years. I've done it successfully. With other companies, for large companies, so I've enjoyed quite a lot of success. The second point is that even within those organizations, as large as they could be, you always had to have an entrepreneurship spirit to succeed within those organizations. So it's not always a cliche that you have the organization that's behind you that's going to help you. It's more you trying to move the needle within the organization, trying to execute a vision, trying to do well while you're navigating the organization. So that's the second point. And then the third point, I just thought, and we just thought, because I partnered with a former colleague and who's also a very good friend, we really thought that we could replicate the success that we had the company at all the companies that we work with or we work at, if we just did it for ourselves. Because we knew how to do it, we knew how to succeed. We knew also how to be entrepreneurs, and those are things that we've done. And we just think that, you know, the combination of all this within a smaller organization would make sense.
How has this background in science and engineering informed your portfolio management in a more like in an actual way? Like, what have you used that has worked from your science background?
From the science, I mean, if I'm just talking about characteristics or features, that would be the rigor that you and discipline that you acquire while you're going through all the formation and the education and all the projects and the research, and you have that sort of relentlessness to kind of going and try to find what you're looking for and to make it work. And there's also something that I don't discount is the ability to learn. So you can take any book or you can take any field that you don't know much about. And I'm even talking within finance. And you take any field that you don't know much about, and then you just go and you learn, and you try to apply all those, I would say, the discipline and rigor that you acquire for your education to what you do on a day-to-day basis. The other thing is like in terms of methodology, and I don't want to get too much into the quantitative methodology, but that would be, it's really predictive models. It's all based on mathematics and statistics, probabilities, and then you try to inform your decisions to based on, you know, how much you think that this or that company is value, and what's the real value of the company, and you try to take advantage of that.
So far, what have you learned? What are the challenges of launching a new portfolio management firm in this environment and in general?
Yes. So to take a step back, what's really unique about the firm that we launched is that it is at the intersection of quantitative investing and what we call ESG, environmental, social, and governance. Just because we think and we believe that taking into account considerations like issues about environment, about social issues, and taking into account governance issues help mitigate the risk in your portfolios, and also help increase long-term, can help increase the value of your portfolios. And so I would say the challenge is, we did not, when we were talking about launching the company, we did not plan the pandemic. We didn't say, or we did not do it in the middle of the pandemic. We basically launched it and then the pandemic happened. But what happened is that the pandemic really reinforced our interest and reinforced our determination in making this work. Just because when you talk about environmental or just sustainability, you see a lot of connections with what has been happening, whether the pandemic itself, what created it. You can argue that this is due to the environment crisis, because some animals are being pushed out from their natural habitat, so it creates those type of possibilities for viruses. The second thing is that when everyone went and tried to abide by the stay-at-home order, everywhere in the world, we saw the effect and the impact on the environment. I remember sometimes I went to the beach, and I was in New York, and I could see the Empire State from where I was standing, and it was not possible before. So that means, you know, there are things that can be done to kind of help the environment. We are really creating our own climate change. So those are things that kind of more resonate more with what's happening. And finally, not the least, is all the social issues and social unrest. And we saw it unfold. We talked about the essential workers. Most of the time, you know, people who were fortunate enough to work for banks, for corporates, they just went back home, or someone just went to their secondary home, stayed at home, while a lot of people who are less fortunate, I'm talking about delivery guys, I'm talking about post office, I'm talking about all those construction workers, they had to go to work, and they were exposed to that virus. And if you just look at New York, and I'm sure it's the same everywhere in the world, that virus disproportionately affected people with lower income socially. Yeah. And the second social issue is all those unrest that we saw here in the US and also in everywhere in the world, with the succession of deaths of black unarmed men or women at the hand of police officers.
So how do you translate that into interest from investors on your ESG product? I know that that's generally the challenge. You know, everybody can say that they are on for these, you know, these causes and for fixing all this. But, you know, beyond donating to a charity, the moment in which you ask them to use, you know, their portfolio, their investment portfolio to actually back up that philosophy, that's another story.
No, that's a very fair point. And you know, just to say it differently, is that if you are an investor and I ask you, oh, do you care about the environment? Do you care about social issues? Yeah, you will all say yes. You know, why not? But if I tell you, if I go back to you after 3 months and I say, yeah, I made some investments for you, but actually I could have earned you 5%, but I'm only earning 3% because I had to not invest in some of the securities because, you know, they were not up to the standard in terms of environment or social. If you're an investor, you're not going to be happy. So, you know, we totally know that. And the way we do it is really, you know, it's, of course, we want to do good. But as an investment manager, our first mission is our first responsibility is the fiduciary duty is really to maximize the return the best way possible. So what we do is that you cannot take into account all the factors, all the ESG factors. You have to pick your battles. And so what we did is that we have identified some factors that we believe are material, meaning they are financially relevant. So taking into account those factors, we know can not only mitigate the risk, like reduce the risk that you can be exposed to, but also help you with the value of your portfolio, or at least, you know, you get the same type of return that you were expecting, which is fine. There's that third dimension, which is in terms of, you know, how comfortable, do you want to do good based on some of the metrics? You can respond yes. So it's possible to do good on some of the metrics and yet to retain the type of expected returns that you are aspiring to. And also to reduce the type of to reduce some of the risk, because, you know, to tell you the truth, there are in finance we usually look at only financial risks, but there are a lot of non-financial risks that are going to become or that are going to have financial consequences in the future, and those are things that we'd like to reduce right now, identify and reduce.
So tell me, in the last 2 years, we like to speak here a lot about the management of asset management firms, you know, the growth, the challenges, the structuring challenges, the selling challenges, the marketing challenges. What have been your greatest challenges and what has surprised you so far in terms of, you know, managing a firm coming from the corporate world?
It's very particular. You know, we spoke about COVID earlier. I would say that's the biggest surprise because you never expect actually to start a company and have to weather a pandemic of a bigger proportion. So that was the biggest surprise. But like I say, I always see crisis as also an opportunity. And, you know, when you think about companies, most of the, I would say the best, the most successful companies today were founded or started in times of crisis. So my take is like, if we do okay, if we are doing okay in times of crisis, the ceiling, the sky would be really the limit, when things get better. That was the first surprise, I would say. And, you know, that was a big one. That's really the.
That's everybody's. That's in everybody's list. So
that's a big one. And just to go back
COVID,
in.
Let's talk. You know.
Yeah, just COVID.
Can we do that? I'm not sure, but the management, the day to day of an asset management firm. You know what's the challenge? What's the most difficult part?
You mean in terms of COVID or outside in normal times?
Normal times.
In normal times, you know, what I like to tell people is that when we started after a career of 20 years for one and 19 years for the other. So we know exactly where we were working to and what we were working into. So that's the first point. So I can argue that it's not an idea that we had for 3 months and we just decided to do it. It's arguably something that's been in the making for the last 20 years or even more. And throughout all those 20 years, we always maintain a table and with two columns, one of the do's and one of the don'ts. So the don'ts are basically things that we saw people implement in the past in terms of people management, in terms of process management, in terms of the way of doing things that either was not successful or actually just led to an impasse. So we know that we're not even going to try that.
Let's go deeper into that. I like it.
Okay.
Yeah, don't. Come on.
One don't?
Yes, one or two or three.
So my favorite don't is that you don't need a PowerPoint to make a point. You know, in corporate lives, and in my corporate lives, I know we would ask a question to people. They would go back and come back to us with 40 slides, where they spent a lot of time. They just added more problems. They would come to you with issues and challenges and risks. No answer. And then you will have another meeting to try to understand what they meant with those slides. Go back, write the minutes. And then, you know, it's just like non-ending. And I can tell you, in the large companies I work at, it's not the fault of the company. It's just also the fact that, you know, those are big, and the more people you have, the more ideas you have to brass. So it's really hard. You know, you do a meeting and then minutes of the meeting and then another meeting to talk about the minutes and then another meeting. So things takes forever. And where you really need. So being nimble like we are now, we can go faster. And like I say, we know the do and the don't. And this is one of the don'ts I gave you. And same thing, another don't. It's more like a do. It's like, you know, when we have an idea, we want that idea to go from ideation to a product in less than 3 months.
Okay.
This is what I would like.
How did you come up with that number?
How did I come up with that number?
Yeah.
It's just experience because of everything that needs to do. Actually, ideally we would like 45 days, but we know it's not always easy. We also have to compose with like the regulator. We have to compose with outside partners that we work with. That's why. But all this in contrast with what you can have when you work for a big company where you can spend a lot of time, actually more time, I would say 80% of the time, convincing stakeholders internally while you have a client waiting for you for a solution. And he's already a buyer. He just wants to do it. And you have the solution, but you have to spend time. And then it could take 6 months, it could take a year. And sometimes the client is patient, sometimes he's not.
Right. And do you use any type of philosophy that you like, you know, all of those? There are many mindset or process books out there that talk about how to launch products and how to iterate, etc. Do you use any of those, or is this just built on your experience?
It's really built on an experience, you know, and because, you know, we also evolved. We saw, you know, I navigated large companies. I navigated also smaller companies. The challenges are not the same, you know, sometimes when you're a big company, you're like, I wish I was in a smaller company. Everything would be faster, nimbler. And then when you're in small companies, you're like, I wish I would be in a large company, then I would have more resources.
Right.
I can be faster, but I'm not rich because I need the money of large companies, the backup. So there's always pluses and minuses. And throughout my career and actually our respective careers, we were able to kind of find the sweet spots for a lot of those things. And I can tell you what we were able to do in the last few months. I know for a fact it would take normally 1 year or 2 years minimum to get off the ground if we didn't have the experience and if we didn't have the success we had before and the know-how. And, you know, part of the success also is, you know, because we had failures too. It's also part of the game, you know. And because you had those failures, you learn lessons and then you can apply them. And, you know, today when we take a direction and we say, oh, we're going to do it this way, we are able to say, no, actually, it's not going to work or it's going to be too long or just because down the road, the product is not going to be viable or we're not going to be able to invest it. Those are the type of lessons and expertise and experience that we have. On top, of course, of the books and all the seminars, everything we've done. That's 20 years is a lot of meetings.
So, and in terms of team management, what are the, you know, you mentioned, you know, I have in the do's and don'ts the team. What's your philosophy?
It's empowering. It's really, I really consider ourselves as leaders, but we also want to be empowering leaders. And meaning that, you know, I don't believe that, you know, you are just a leader because you have the title or because somebody puts you in position and say, oh, you're the boss, now manage. People have to follow. I don't really believe in that style of leadership. I saw it, you know, sometimes, you know, it doesn't respect. But at the end of the day, when you're managing people, what you want is that is to bring the best out of them, is to really maximize their potential. So the type of leadership I believe in is a leadership where you really empower people. You establish communication. It has to go two ways. People should not be afraid to critique you, and they should not be also afraid of taking criticism. This is very important. And so the way I define leadership is really that ability to inspire people and to make them know the potential that they have in them and realize that potential.
I like that. I've had in the past, and I've seen that happen in corporate world, in some medium-sized companies, in financial services, where you get a lot of the, what I like to call the prima donnas.
Yes.
In which that culture of starship, of, you know, raising stars, I find is sometimes not in the best interest of clients or the organization. How do you avoid that? Because, you know, it's very easy to get into that bandwagon when you are.
It's very easy, but, you know, it's character. It's really character because, you know, we know who we are. We've known each other for, I'm talking about the leadership. We've known each other for more than 15 years. So it's all good from there. So now what you want to pay attention to is to the people that you're bringing on board. One thing I can tell you, Alejandra, is that we are never going to be a 100,000 people company. Wow. We are going to be lean, and we know how to do it being lean. When I say lean, is 20 people max, maybe 25 is really we go crazy. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we are not going to be successful. We are going to be successful, and you can manage tons of assets just being five people or six people. The reason why we're going to be a bit more is because we really want to advance research and have researchers just promoting research, doing research, writing papers, providing thought leadership, because we think that this is also our way to have a voice and to put our thumb on the scales. So now when you have such a small group of people that you have to manage, this is where you really want to pay attention to people you bring on board. And same thing, like I say, 20 years in the industry, we know a lot of people. We almost know everyone. And we know who we want to work with. We want who we do not want to work with. Who we cannot really work with. And this is, you know, the type of things that you can do. And once the people are on board, of course, you want to pay attention to how it's going. And like I say, you know, the minute you let people shine, it's all really good for not only for the company and also for what we're trying to achieve. Because at the end of the day, this is about the mission. It's about what we're doing. It's not about ourselves. And I would say you could be the president of the United States, for instance, and or the president of any country, and you don't need to know everything about everything. What you need to is to have the ability to surround yourself with people who are really good at what they do, and you have the ability to listen to them. Because if you don't listen to them, you're just paying them for nothing.
So I'd like to ask this, you know, to close a couple of questions. You know, mm-hmm. Basically, you're very good at, you know, what you do and your career, clearly. What are you not very good at?
I'm not good with choices. That's my little confession. To give you, when I say choices in everyday life, of course, to give you an example, it's all the contrast between being in France and also being in the US. if I walk into a coffee shop in France and I say, I want a coffee, they would go back, give me a coffee, and I would leave. If I walk in a Starbucks here and I say, I want a coffee, I'm going to have so many choices and so many questions to answer up until I get my coffee. Okay. So do you want dark roast? Do you want, you know, chicken roast? Do you want red roast? And then if they say, oh, do you want milk? No milk. Do you want sugar? No sugar. The cup, how do you want it? Do you want it closed, open?
Well, that's a way of saying you like things simple.
I like to keep things simple.
Good.
Exactly.
And another fun one for you. So if heaven exists, what would you like God to say when you arrive?
Heaven exists.
Okay.
Heaven does exist.
You have to stay neutral.
No. I know. I want him to tell me that heaven does exist. Yeah.
Okay. I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
And I like the irony of it. Yeah. So when I get there, I want him to say, yeah, heaven does exist. So that means I'm there. And he just opened the door and I'm just going to run into it.
That's cool. Okay. This was fun. Thank you so much. And
my pleasure.
And look forward to more from you in the future.
Likewise. Thank you, Alejandra.
Take care.